Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 11th of August 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson, of course. And we're delighted to be joined today by David Scott, bringing us Northern Exposure. A little bit on the rainy side, but last day of UK Column before we break for the holiday period. So I think we can cope with that, Mike.
I think we can. Okay. We'll get straight on to Brexit because another day, another EU institution that we don't want to be leaving, Brian. So this is a speech which was given by Lord O'Shaughnessy. It was actually given on the 14th of July, but the government just published it today. So I just thought we'd mention it because he basically said, I hope today we'll be able to detail some of the work that is going on to help shape the future relationship with the EU, in particular, define the principles which are informing our approach. Today I will set out in practical terms the government's position on medicines regulation, trade and support for the life sciences sector in the UK. We're absolutely clear that three principles must underpin any future relationship with the EU. Firstly, patients must not be put at a disadvantage. Second, the UK will continue to play a leading role promoting and ensuring public health both in Europe and around the world. And third, industry must be able to get their products into the UK market as quickly and simply as possible, with the UK and Europe at the forefront of medical innovation. So he said that patients across the EU27, including those in the UK, have been well served by our close cooperation with Europe for many years, and that patients across the EU27 and the UK would be better served if together we continue the strong, effective technical collaboration that accelerates scientific advancement and ultimately benefits patient well-being. Now, I'm not necessarily suggesting that comment is wrong, but clearly, Brian, we have yet another instance of us not leaving European institutions. So once again, I just want to reiterate that Brexit is a fraud.
Yes, Brexit light with no exit. We should also, of course, remind people that the NHS deeply embedded into the European project. And of course, the NHS has had its own EU headquarters for many years. And I don't think the NHS will be giving up that headquarters anytime soon.
Mm. At the heart of the Brexit debate in the UK, at least, David, is unionism. So what's Darren McGarvey been up to in Scotland?
Oh, this is very funny. This is a little update on the independence movement, the so-called Yes campaign in Scotland. Having spent some 4 or 5 years abusing unionists or anyone who questions their policy, who will be equated with a unionist and called a Tory and called very many bad names, they've now turned on themselves. And there is much infighting in the Yes movement. And for those who love liberty, it's been really quite fun to watch.
And what have they been up to? They've been putting tweets out.
Well, look, this next bit here, this shows you the type of tweet. This is between Ross Grier, who's a Green Party politician and leader of the Yes campaign, and Peter A. Bell, the grumpiest man in Perth, who we've reported on in the article on Getting to Yes, and a long-time supporter of Scottish nationalism. And yes, they're not getting on. He called him a pathetic bag of snot, and what was the other one? Twerp, I think. So there's a lot of invective flying around. Now, this comes from a dispute over essentially the sort of social justice agenda that they're driving, but they don't quite see it the same way. A very nasty blogger that's at the heart of Scottish nationalism called Wings Over Scotland, who's blocked me. I'm number 407 on his blocked list. If you're decent in Scotland, you're on the Wings blocked list, which he released the comma separated value file, so all people with similar views can block all the same people. He said Oliver Mundell, the son of the Scottish secretary, is the sort of public speaker that makes you wish his dad had embraced his homosexuality sooner. So, wow. A nasty, unpleasant, personal comment. That's the sort of thing that you get from this particular blogger. The leader of the Scottish Labour Party, Kezia Dugdale, who is herself a lesbian, accused him of being homophobic, which obviously in the world of a social justice warrior is a very bad thing indeed. And so he has decided to sue her in the courts for, I think at the last count, it was £25,000 for calling him homophobic. So this has erupted into a huge internecine struggle between those in the Yes campaign who think he is homophobic and those who don't, and they're all getting at one another and fighting like rats in a sack. And that's where we are this week.
Dear, oh dear. Okay, let's move on to more serious subjects, I suppose. Yesterday we were talking about the issue of Rochdale and everything that was going on around that. And Amber Rudd now has waded into the conversation. She says that this was an abhorrent case of sexual predators preying on young women and girls, and I'm pleased that they've been brought to justice. She said, I want to be absolutely clear that political and cultural sensitivities must never be allowed to get in the way of preventing and uncovering it, child abuse. Now, this is the latest attempt to, in fact, cover up everything that has gone on there and in other places, including Oxford, in recent years. Because, of course, now what they're saying is that it was the unfortunate situation that these race crimes could not be investigated because the people that were committing these crimes would have been accused of being racist. This is the most ridiculous, unbelievable rhetoric I think I've ever heard.
They're getting desperate, Mike.
Absolutely. Now we are not investigating criminal acts because we might be considered racist. This is nonsense. The Labour MP for Rotherham, Rochdale, one of the other places, of course, that was affected by this, but Rotherham, the MP for Rotherham, Sarah Champion, said, a fear of being called racist has prevented authorities from investigating the reasons behind sexual abuse cases. I find that language extremely interesting. Prevented authorities from investigating the reasons behind sexual abuse cases. They're not even at that point. They're supposed to be at the point of investigating the abuse cases themselves and bringing to justice anybody that has abused a child, not looking at the reasons behind it. So that maybe gives us a clue as to what's going on here. And then, of course, we have the usual suspects, Katie Hopkins, coming out and saying, breaking news on Twitter, this was, Muslims say Muslim grooming gangs are not a Muslim issue. And the Muslims are absolutely right. This is not a Muslim issue. This is much, much broader than being a Muslim issue. Yes, these were Muslim Asian gangs in these cases. But David, it's not just Muslims.
It is not just Muslims. It is most certainly not just Muslims. This is a blog from Calamity Cat, one of the researchers in Scotland. And she's looking here at some more information that we're in the process of assembling regarding Sir Nicholas Fairbairn. Now, Sir Nicholas was Perth and Kinross MP. He was in the Thatcher cabinet, and he was the second highest law officer in Scotland. And he was not Asian, but he was, however, raping children. This is one of the reports from a while ago. Lady called Susie Henderson has gone on the record, waived her right to anonymity, to reveal that she was raped by Sir Nicholas Fairbairn when she was 4, and she was also raped by her well-connected QC father. So you're seeing here, again, the sort of ring-like structure of the paedophile abuse. Now, what we're now learning from another victim of Sir Nicholas Fairbairn and a much wider, a much larger abuse network that this in this case a man was subject to abuse by, is that the abuse was long term, it was satanic and ritual in its nature, and it involved every form of horror, including murder, that you could possibly imagine. So this is the nature of the criminality of the evil that we're dealing with, and it goes much beyond any one community.
So this is the Daily Mail's headline, revealed the full horrific truth about Sir Nicholas Fairbairn. From what you're saying, the Mail has not, in fact, revealed the full horrific truth about Sir Nicholas Fairbairn. There's plenty more to discover.
They're almost scratching the surface, yes.
Yes.
And we hope to be in a position, we're discussing this with one of the victims, and we hope to be in a position to actually report fully on the extent of this when that person is ready, because it involves every sort of abuse that it's possible to imagine, and it involves many high-ranking people in Scottish society, and it involves places and locations which we're in the process of identifying, not very far from where I'm sitting just now.
So you wanted me to include the section out of Wikipedia entitled "The Lord Advocate and Solicitor General for Scotland." Why was that?
Well, the issue here is, who was this man, right? Because here we know he's from Susie Henderson. He was assaulting 4-year-olds, and he was also involved in we're now discovering, in satanic abuse. But who was he? He was a QC. He was extremely well connected. If you read this article, you'll find he was within a whisker. He was favourite to be Lord Advocate for Scotland. Now, Lord Advocate is in charge of all criminal prosecution in Scotland and personally deals with all the serious cases.
So what do we imagine?
He was actually deputy. He was Solicitor General, so he was deputy to the Lord Advocate. But he only got that one step down because of his flamboyant, controversial nature. He was one step away from running the entire criminal prosecution service in Scotland. And he was a Satanist, and he was abusing children. That illustrates how close to the centre of power and to the centre of things like police, Crown Office, judiciary, this goes. And that's another reason why perhaps it's not investigated the way it might be.
David, if I may just come in here and say for our viewers and listeners, of course, that if you have any doubt that this aspect of Satanism is real, then we ought to come back to the BBC reports that the Ministry of Defence some years ago approved Satanism as one of the religions that could be practiced on board Her Majesty's warships. So the practice of Satanism, excuse me, real, recognised by the British government, promoted by the British government as something perfectly acceptable to take place on board warships. And then, of course, we've got numerous reports where the police have successfully prosecuted abuse cases with ritualistic settings. So the evidence is in front of our eyes. But of course, the moment we know that the government itself is prepared to promote this, we are on the trail to something very dangerous indeed. And I can also add that I'm aware that in the last few days, a member of the public has spoken to Judge Mumby's office, head of the Family Law Division, of course, simply pointing out that since Satanism is recognised by the government as an acceptable religion, and there are judges who practice this religion, perhaps those judges should declare that religion before judging in cases involving the abuse of children. I understand that this particular query into Judge Mumby's office produced an extraordinary response from one of his key members of staff. But we'll have more on that after our return from holiday.
The National Crime Agency has offered up its response to modern slavery, as it's described, and of course is talking about human trafficking and quite a lot about sex trafficking. And they are saying that the true scale of modern slavery is far more prevalent than previously estimated. They're suggesting that that there is plenty of it going on within every major city and in this country. So this is not something that applies to foreign lands. It's going on here. They're saying a growing body of evidence resulting from an increase in law enforcement activity points to the number of victims being much higher than estimated and the threat continuing to expand. So the NCA yesterday released figures showing that there are currently more than 300 live policing operations targeting modern slavery in the UK. More than a dozen of the highest risk operations targeting organised crime groups are being led by the National Crime Agency. Recent operational results of those, including the various arrests and other things going on. A lot of Eastern European involvement in this. And of course, Eastern Europeans, not necessarily Muslims, Brian. And indeed, the gent that David is talking about, not Muslim. So, as I say, this goes well beyond being a Muslim problem.
Well, the Asian Muslim issue I believe, is a smokescreen. Is that abuse taking place in those communities? Absolutely. But of course, while the focus can be put on Asians or Muslims, the focus, the spotlight, is not on the heart of British government, where, of course, we've already got the admission by, on camera, the admission by Tim Fortescue, one of Ted Heath's Conservative Party whips, saying that members of parliament came to the whips in order to have little problems with little boys cleared up. That evidence is simply not being followed up. And at the moment, Theresa May apparently refuses to give any sort of apology for the behaviour of MPs in that time, at least. However, we still suspect it's going on today. Well, of course, the police, in the aspect of child abuse, not performing well. Just going to come on to this article from the Yorkshire Evening Post. South Yorkshire police worker accused of exposing himself. Now, this was a police worker, a member of staff. It wasn't actually a police constable. But this is one of a number of incidents, some of which do include the police themselves, where there does not appear to be appropriate activity. But if we just stay on this one, a member of police staff, while off duty, parked his private vehicle outside a parade of shops and had his lower clothes pulled down around his thighs, exposing himself. This was seen by a member of the public who walked by. They reported it to the police. The reaction from the College of Policing was, and the police themselves, was that they take all incidents of this kind seriously and carry out internal misconduct investigations when necessary. The Crown Prosecution said it did consider criminal prosecution, but the evidential threshold for prosecution was not met, and the CPS made the decision not to take the case forward. So a man exposes himself, a member of the public sees that, correctly reports it to the police, but it's the CPS that decides that there's nothing really to be taken forward. So we have a crime, we have a witness who sees that crime, but the view of the CPS is no further action. Well, we just thought we'd have a little look at that College of Policing. This lady, Millie Banerjee, is the chair. And the final part of the article, which I've just indicated to you, has got this statement. The College of Policing's Code of Ethics defines the standards of behaviour expected of everyone who works in policing, and the code comprehensively covers a whole range of issues which our employees should consider when making decisions and using their judgment. These issues include honesty and integrity, respect and courtesy, and professional conduct. So the police worker in question got a written warning, I believe. That was the end of it. Nothing from CPS. Well, I was a little bit curious about where this lady had come from, because we've been reporting this week over the number of very powerful people now appearing in control of areas of the civil service. So this particular lady, if we actually have a look at her background, she's apparently spent long and varied career in the private and public sectors, 25 years with BT, ICO at Global Communications, chair of Working Links, board member of East London Foundation Trust. She's had other jobs, non-executive director of the Cabinet Office, Channel 4, Prison Board, Peabody Trust, Ofcom, Postwatch, Carnegie UK Trust, and chair of British Transport Police. This lady can do everything, Mike.
Amazing. Another one.
It's just quite incredible. Apparently, she had a degree in zoology, if I've spelt that correctly. I hope I have, otherwise people would be doubting the veracity of this news.
Yes.
But how do you get from that background to such a powerful position in training the police? How does this happen?
No idea.
We don't know. So where do we follow through to? Well, let's come on to the Crown Prosecution Service. How did they make this judgment not to prosecute? Well, they went through their so-called threshold tests. Let's bring it up on screen to make this a little bit clearer. So prosecutors must be satisfied there's at least a reasonable suspicion that the person to be charged has committed the offence. So the man dropped his trousers, somebody saw it, reported it to the police, but they weren't quite sure.
No.
No. And if we bring in the next part of the test here, well, the second part is, can further evidence be gathered to provide a realistic prospect of conviction? So there was an offence committed. We had a witness. It was reported. But we need to go and see whether there was anybody to witness the witness witnessing the issue, Mike.
Yeah, yeah.
That appears to be the case. And then they go on to say the prosecutor's got to consider the nature, extent, admissibility of further evidence, the charges, the reason why evidence is not available. It starts to become very blurred. And then in comes this, which is the public interest stage. And when you read this, my feeling was this is not to help the public in any way. These are reasons that the Crown Prosecution Service can use not to prosecute.
So basically, if they get through the first two stages and they still haven't found a way to avoid prosecuting their best mate, then they go to the public interest test and they just say, well, it's not in the public interest, and that's the end of it.
Absolutely correct. And if we just have a look at the key points in that test, we've got this. How serious is the offence committed? What is the level of culpability? What are the circumstances and the harm caused to the victim? Was the suspect underage? What was the impact on the community? Is prosecution a proportionate response? This is like prejudging the case.
Absolutely.
Prejudging. Do sources of information require protecting? The one that isn't listed in their list of key points here is the fact they also consider how much money it's going to cost the Crown Prosecution Service to prosecute, because they might not want to prosecute because it might sort of cost them a bit too much money, spoil the budget.
Yeah.
But the good news is they do protect victims. So here's the image from their website, Victims and Witnesses, championing justice and defending the rights of victims fairly, firmly and effectively is at the heart of all we do. And of course, it was that very same Crown Prosecution Service that prosecuted victim, witness, survivor and child abuse whistleblower Melanie Shaw. And while we're taking 2 weeks off, Melanie remains in solitary confinement, thanks to the Crown Prosecution Service, after a mere 12 months. Crown Prosecution Service could spend more time in China, I think, Mike.
Possibly.
Yeah.
What's next?
I'll just give you this very quickly because I have an eye on the clock. But here we've got how the system has been blurred. So pre-1986, we had the police investigating the crime and then deciding if prosecution was necessary. After 1986, in came the Crown Prosecution Service, where government-appointed lawyers decided if that prosecution to take place. The police, of course, were able to use local knowledge with respect to the crime, public interest and the perpetrator themselves. But now we've got the Crown Prosecution able to use public interest as a means to not prosecute. The police held full responsibility and accountability for preventing, investigating crime and taking actions to prosecute. So if there was a problem, you knew where to go, which was the police. Now we've got money and cost becoming a very important area for the Crown Prosecution Service. Previously, the police could achieve measurable results with what they were doing. But now the money is taking over what the Crown Prosecution Service is doing. We also can say that local constabulary had relatively high independence from central government, but the CPS is fully government appointed and controlled. So it would appear on the surface, at least, that the Crown Prosecution Service is designed to confuse the system and make sure that prosecutions can be controlled.
Yeah. OK, let's come on to Grenfell Tower then, because the question is, where is the money going? Now, this is the Charity Commission has released some figures on this. About the donations that have been made since the Grenfell Tower fire 2 months ago now, and they show that less than 15% of the £18.9 million raised has been given to people who lost their homes or were affected by this. Now, of course, this is a subject that we covered I think about 4 weeks ago now, yeah. So it's about time the Charity Commission caught up. But let's just have a quick look at what they've said here. This table shows the amount of money that has been collected and the amount of money that has been distributed. And on the second page of this table, they show the organisations that the money has gone to. But what's interesting is that they have given a breakdown of the money going to what they describe as distributing organisations. So these are organisations which are then tasked with distributing the money further. So the Charity Commission claiming to be completely transparent here and making sure that we know exactly what money has been collected and who that money has gone to. But that is as far as it goes to the distributing organisations. We do not know where that money has gone to since that point. However, they produced a further document, and it was this one, which was all about how the types of grants that are available to people that have been affected by the Grenfell Tower fire and where they can get that money from. So I've just put one example here. This is from about halfway down this page. It says, for each household in Grenfell Tower and those households from the surrounding area that will never be able to return to their homes, there is a £2,000 emergency grant. And there's £10,000 as a fresh start grant. And in brackets, it says, please note, this is in addition to the fresh start grant separately offered by the Kensington and Chelsea Foundation. Kensington and Chelsea Foundation, one of the organisations that is described as a distributing organisation. But of course, what the Charity Commission doesn't do is make any mention of the effect that such grants will have on people's benefits received from the Department for Work and Pensions. And we already know that the original £5 million tranche of money, which was given out as an interim payment by the government, which was £500 in cash immediately and £5,000 put into people's bank accounts, we already know that when people were accepting that the DWP was coming along and saying, oh, well, sorry, guys, you've now got too much money in your bank account. We're cutting your housing benefit or we're cutting other benefits. So what is the effect of these people receiving this money on their benefits? Because if they are being affected in this way, they're not going to take the money. In which case, I come back to the question, the original question. We now know which distributing organisations have received the £2.5 million that's been distributed so far. Where has it gone after that? Because all that we've heard so far is that it is not getting to people on the ground.
And we can say to our audience today, please give us some help with this. This is exactly the sort of thing that Freedom of Information Act can assist with. If you get in your questions to these organisations, if they're taking government money, they're also caught up in the Freedom of Information Act. So it should be possible to ask for this information if they refuse to give it. I think we're beginning to understand that the money is missing.
Just briefly, David, any comments?
On Grenfell, yeah. The money is a very strange situation because a huge amount of public outpouring of sympathy happened at that point. And we know that the British public under such circumstances is extremely generous. And if this has been in any way properly organised, there would be ample money available within that community for anything that was needed. And yet the state's moved in. It all seems to have been seized and centrally administered, and it's now completely opaque to the people of Grenfell, and that's very worrying. Just one point I would also go back to. You mentioned earlier on the trafficking industry. Just to put this in scale, and thanks to Vicky Von Blackwood, one of the speakers at the Fresh Start Foundation conference, for this information. The Office of National Statistics has answered the question, how many prostitutes are there in the United Kingdom? And the answer is 60,879. And that generates £5.314 billion per year on UK GDP. But that's only female prostitution. If you add in male prostitution, the total comes up to £8.86 billion per year. So that's the scale of trafficking that's going on in the UK.
Yes, and of course that puts the meagre budgets that law enforcement has to try to cope with this in a bit of perspective, and that is the business model that they run. Now, just before I mention holidays, Brian, I just want to say thank you to everybody that wished me a happy birthday on Facebook yesterday. Unfortunately, it wasn't actually my birthday because I didn't particularly want to tell Facebook what day my birthday was. But anyway, your best wishes are much appreciated nonetheless. And thank you very much for that. But we are on holiday as of this afternoon for the next couple of weeks. We'll be back on Thursday, the 31st of August. Hopefully with fresh enthusiasm.
Yes, I'm sure that'll be true. Somebody did mention a hamster wheel to us, and we have to say production of the news can occasionally be a little bit hamsterish.
Tonight, Humanity versus Insanity, Ian Crane is in the studio. He will have Dr. Graham Downing with him. They're talking about the scandalous promotions, is how they're describing it. Who's screwing your kids? WHO being the World Health Organization, the scandalous promotion of teen sexual deviancy and the HPV agenda is what it's about tonight at 7:30, ukcolumn.org/live. And then at 9 o'clock, Fracking Nightmare, and I'm quite sure Ian will be discussing further the INEOS injunction that we talked about on the news a day or two ago.
Okay, well, let's come over to the subject of terrorism. We'll just do this very briefly, but I was amused to see this gentleman, Jonathan Evans, ex-MI5, in an article, big article in The Telegraph. He said, I think on the terrorism side, we're at least 20 years into this. My guess is that we'll be dealing with a long tail in another 20 years' time. It's all bad news. There's going to be terror, terror, more terror. And I just had to put in brackets that, after all, I think he should know this is the case because of all the good work that MI5 and our other security services have done in helping to foment that terror. He went on, he said, I think this is genuinely a generational problem. When I left MI5 in 2013, if I had been asked, I would have said that I thought we probably were over the worst of the Al-Qaeda threat. But then he goes on to say, that may have been true, but of course not the development and emergence of IS with the same ideology and many of the same people. So he didn't realise that the people were going to carry on doing what they were doing. He said, I think that we're going to be facing 20, 30 years of terrorist threats, and therefore we need absolutely critically to persevere and just keep doing it.
Doing what?
Creating the terror threat, presumably, Mike.
Yeah, that's how I took it when I heard him.
He's smiling while he's saying this. I think he's got a very smug, self-satisfied expression on his face. They've done a good job creating the terror, and we're going to have to put up with it for at least another 30 years.
Of course, the other terror which is being imposed on us at the moment is the fire and fury of North Korea. Now, Donald Trump absolutely using pretty strong rhetoric with regard to North Korea. And yet, all the while, he and his key staff are in the background negotiating, and not just him, because Russia are negotiating as well. Lavrov met up with the North Korean foreign minister, Ri Yong-ho, the other day. So did the Chinese, so they're trying to sort the problem out as well. Lots of people trying to talk about the thing. Even Tillerson was saying talks with the right expectation of what those talks will be about was what was in his mind. So, you know, there is this public face of what Trump is doing, which we could discuss why he's doing that. I think for a start, he's intentionally winding up the mainstream media. I think he's having some fun winding up the mainstream media while there's this kind of back channel going on under the surface. You might say that that's a dangerous thing to do, but on the other hand, the mainstream media absolutely out of control with regard to Trump, so I don't think I can really blame him for it if that's what he's up to. Alternative explanation, it might be that he's simply saying what he's saying with a view to improving the share price of certain defence contractors, defence companies. But in the meantime, who's driving it? Well, as we mentioned, The Economist the other day, other mainstream media driving it, British government absolutely hoping that Trump and North Korea get to it as quickly as possible. And in order to help, they're sending RAF jets to spy on Kim Jong-un in North Korea. I didn't actually realise we had any that we could send there, but apparently we do. We have these ones, the RC-135W, which, as you would imagine, are American and not British.
Yeah, I'm just interested in the rivet joint bit, Mike, because there used to be a joke about an aircraft called the Shackleton, which was described as rivets flying in close formation.
Right.
So I don't know whether they've progressed over the build of this aircraft.
Well, this is a Boeing, so you would hope they might have. But anyway, a source close to the situation with this these RAF aircraft going over to North Korea said, although a conflict between North Korea and America and their allies is unthinkable, everything that can be done is being done to prepare for it if it happens. So there you go. That's good. The Australians, according to the Financial Times, this is Malcolm Turnbull, who, of course, is another extremely level-headed Western leader. He is saying that he will invoke the Mutual Defense Pact if North Korea attacks the United States. So we're all piling in on this. Getting back to Trump himself and the people he has around him, it's been a long topic of discussion between Patrick Henningsen and myself as to the various personalities in and around him. And we absolutely, unfortunately, agree with New Republic here that Mike Pence is probably, who's the vice president.
The controller.
Not the controller, but the one person that is absolutely doing everything he can to agitate, undermine any possibility of a shift in position for the United States with regard to Russia, with regard to China, and North Korea being used as the sort of piggy in the middle in that particular discussion. But Mike Pence doing everything that he can possibly do to undermine any moves that Trump may have to try to normalize relations between these countries.
Interesting situation. Just before I put up a slightly amusing slide, David, has Scotland been threatened by the North Koreans at all?
No, we're emulating the North Koreans, so they're no threat to us. On the subject of amusing things, I mean, you just read out there that a conflict is unthinkable, but we're engaged in detailed plans for it. This is now life imitating art. The film In the Loop had the memorable line that war is neither inevitable nor is it evitable. And that was the line that they were following there. So we seem to be doing much the same thing.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, we just popped this on screen. I enjoyed reading this from the Mail. This is quality journalism. Meanwhile, Britain has put its own intelligence agencies on high alert with MI6 and the listening station GCHQ gathering information to glean information about how other countries are preparing to take on Kim Jong-un.
Good stuff. Is that fake news?
I would have thought it's pretty close to it. We're gathering information to glean information about how other countries are preparing. Aren't the countries that are going to take on Kim Jong-un our friends?
Possibly.
Well, maybe these are friendly terrorists that we're not sure whether they're friendly or not. This is, let's just bring it in here. Utter dross.
Yes. Absolutely.
Room 101 for that, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Right, David, let's talk diversity then.
Yes, James Damore is the Google engineer who was unwise enough as to have an opinion. He wrote a little piece, and it was entitled The Echo Chamber of Google's Ideological Echo Chamber was the piece he wrote. Having gone through some interesting sort of retraining and reframing that he wasn't very comfortable with. This was all done verbally. There was nothing ever written down, and he felt very uncomfortable with the push towards greater diversity, greater female representation, etc., as an end in its own right. Nothing to do with the good of the company, the skills that you're employing, the end product, the service or product that you're delivering, nothing to do with any of that. So he wrote a memo on this, and it was circulated quite widely on the internet, for which he was, of course, fired on the spot, despite having a sterling record and being a model employee and extremely good at his job, by all accounts. That didn't seem to count for anything. He was guilty of wrongthinking. He had to go. Now, normally, this would be the end of the matter, but times are changing, and it appears that there is, in fact, a backlash The internet, the people, the wide dispersed network that is a lot of individual thinking human beings all across the planet, are not happy at this. Google are starting to struggle a little bit. This next slide from The Guardian, who are having real problems with this story, illustrates the problem, because Google cancelled a company-wide meeting on Thursday after several of its employees became targets of Gamergate-style campaign of harassment by internet trolls, angered by the firing of the engineer who'd written the controversial memo on diversity. Quote, "We had hoped to have a frank, open discussion today, as we always do, to bring us together and move forward," says CEO Sundar Pichai. But following the leak of proposed discussed question, he said Googlers, which is the term they use to describe their employees, were being personally named on websites. Oh, the horror. Googlers are writing in, concerned about their safety and worried they may be outed publicly for asking a question at the town hall. So you see, they're not able to campaign against or for this diversity idea, political correctness idea within the company in secret. Right? People are finding out and it's being broadcast, and they're not very happy when it's being broadcast. Now, the next slide illustrates again the problems The Guardian are having with understanding the modern world. Because here, and you can tell in this piece the envy in The Guardian's piece. They said fired Google memo writer gives first big interview to right-wing YouTubers. Who are these terrible right-wing YouTubers, you ask? Is it Stormfront? Is it neo-Nazis? No, it's Stefan Molyneux, who's got the biggest philosophy website in the world. And the gentle Professor Jordan Peterson, who's a very centrist man who's campaigning for free speech. So these are the horrible right-wing YouTubers they're talking about. The more who argued in these memo that biological differences between men and women can contribute to the gender gap in the tech industry, gave a lengthy interview to Stefan Molyneux and Jordan G. Peterson, who have both large followings on YouTube, and exposed anti-feminist views over the horror. So you see there that The Guardian realises it's losing its audience, it's losing its power to shape opinion. It's not very happy about it. And there is a backlash. Very interesting developments indeed. The backlash goes on. The Mail Online filed sexist memo. Google engineer attracts thousands with a new Twitter account, and he's wearing a T-shirt, and it's the Google logo, but it doesn't say Google, it says Gulag, which is beautiful, right? So I'm going to find myself a Gulag T-shirt as soon as possible. So it shows the ideological constraints that these people are resisting, and the encouraging thing is the resistance. And amazingly, there was even an op-ed in the New York Times of all places today, just a few hours before we went live, calling for the resignation of the chief executive of Google over the way he's handled this case. So their ability to hire and fire on ideological grounds in secret is being undermined by the internet, by discussion, by free speech, and isn't it fun to watch?
Yeah, but we've got to shut it down as quickly as possible, David.
Well, they will try, but... there is resistance.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, before we go, we just remind you once again that we're going to have a couple of weeks off.
Are you going anywhere nice?
We'll be local in UK, but I'm going to visit some family I haven't seen for a while, and hopefully the weather's going to be good and we're going to enjoy UK at its best. I'd just like to say a big thank you to people who have been subscribing and donating to the UK column. We had two envelopes arrive through today with donations. One, I can't say who it was from because you didn't tell me, The other one was from a Mike. So, Mike, thank you very much for sending us that donation. We do appreciate the support that we get. We constantly say we need more ongoing support because we want to expand the quality of news that we're putting out. We want to expand the other programmes. And when we come back after the break, we will be moving into some, I think, quite exciting news in due course. We'll tell you more about that at the time. But thank you very much for those donations. Keep it coming if you value the work that UK Column News does. David, thank you very much for joining us north of the border. And I'm going to end on the with a statement that we believe that the rate at which the state is trying to squash free speech is a clear sign that they are extremely worried by the progress of free speech and alternative media worldwide. So if you're on the internet pumping out truth and information, keep going and make sure you get your friends, family and other colleagues involved. We'll be back soon. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.